We'd like to call to order the House Transportation Committee for February 7th. Thank you for joining us today, and thank you for being on time, committee. At this time, we are going to switch the agenda from the posted just a little, and we are going to do our public hearings first. And the first public hearing that we're going to take, because we have our two representatives here to work on this with us, so I'll ask Representative McEwen if she would like to come up with her panel.
On House Bill.
And this is on this is a public hearing on House Bill 4130, the Student Transportation Funding Bill. Welcome. And you can bring up whoever else you want on this bill.
Oh,
and as while you're getting organized and set up, Patrick, if you'd like to go ahead and just give our summary.
Well, sure, you bet, Madam Chair. House Bill 4130 establishes a grant program under which the Department of Education awards grants to school districts for a percentage of certain student transportation costs, for which the school district does not receive any amount in distributions from the state school fund. This measure has an operative date of July 1st of this year. We do not have requested but have not yet received fiscal and revenue impact statements. There is no amendment, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative McEwen.
Chair McLean, Vice Chairs Vile and Meek, members of the committee, what a treat it is to be back in this committee. I'm Catty McEwen. I represent House District 9 down on the South Coast, and I bring before you a bill that I've been working on now for, oh gosh, well over 2 years, close to 3 years. As a former school board member, I've spent a lot of time working on student transportation issues that were specific to my district. And when I came into the House of Representatives, it's always been clear to me that we have limitations on how school districts can spend the money that they receive from the state on transportation. It's limited to yellow buses. And people do a wonderful job of running their transportation departments. That's all well and good. But I've always just been conscious that there was a gap. And we have some school districts in the state who've been very creative about how they have begun to blur that line for students between yellow buses and transit. We have school districts who've received other funds, been creative about how they've done it, and given students more options about how they move around in their communities to take advantage of educational opportunity. And this bill, I think, is an incredibly important bill that we actually brought last session, and in the chaos of trying to move a transportation package, a lot of the air kind of got sucked out of the room on other transportation issues, and this bill just languished in Ways and Means. But I'm bringing it back because I think it's very, very important. What the bill does is it creates a fund at the Oregon Department of Education that can be used by school districts to buy transit passes for students who live in districts where that is appropriate and can create wonderful opportunity to get to community college classes, get back and forth to school if they're staying for after school or before school activities, go to jobs, do all the things that we want students do to be successful in achieving that diploma at the end of the year, at the end of their career, that GED or their diploma. It gives them flexibility, and they're going to need flexibility to be successful. The other thing it does is create a pot of money that students who live in school districts who do not have access to transit, because we want to be consummately fair across the state, could access money to use for activity buses. This is something that in most districts went away many, many years ago when budget constraints hit their school districts and activity buses were no longer able to be done. A lot of school districts used to have a regular route, and then at the end of the day, they'd run a bus for kids who lived in outlying areas who would not be able to get home if they stayed for all of those enriching activities of sports and academics and choir and all of those things that we think are very important. So without belaboring this, because I could go on and on, this is actually a quite simple bill. It changes the language in the law for the Department of Ed to be able for school districts who apply for a grant. This is a grant that they apply for. They have to provide a 50-50 match. In the world of yellow buses, 70% of the money is provided by the state, and the school provides 30%. We made this a 50-50 match for schools to give kids an opportunity to use transit where appropriate, to provide activity buses where appropriate. It's flexible. It opens the door to long-term, I think, ability for kids to hopefully be very successful in achieving that degree or that GED and moving on to whatever career it is they're going into. Secondarily, what it does is it teaches kids the beauty of transit. I want to mention very briefly, too, that in the transportation package, one of the key components was the STIF, the money that is coming from the employee tax into the fund that is extending and enhancing, embellishing, giving transit entities across the state the ability to grow, to reach out into low-income areas, to extend hours, to do all those things that we want to do to make it a much more robust system. I think this dovetails very beautifully with what I'm trying to do with increase the abilities of students to access transit. And so this bill asks for $250,000 to start this fund. It's a very, very small amount. We want to get the pot built. But we are also asking in the transportation package fix-it bill for 1% of the transit money that we are bringing in with the employee tax to stream over into this pot so it creates a consistent small source of revenue for those school districts to have access, not a one-shot, but an existing stream of revenue so that this can be an ongoing issue that can go on into the future and not just be a one-off. And I think that's a very important aspect of this. So two parallel tracks. This sets the law in motion, creates the fund, gets the ORS up to date on what school districts can use it for, and then on the other side of the equation, hopefully we'll be moving forward with streaming more money into that pot for transit. And so I'll turn it over to my good colleague.
Thank you, Chair McLean, Vice Chair Vile, and members of the committee. My name is John Lively. I'm state representative from House District 12, which is essentially the city of Springfield. I am honored to be here today to encourage your support for House Bill 4130. My first session in 2013, I introduced legislation to continue funding for student transit passes. Before 2013, there was money that came from energy tax credits in that districts, LTD and other large transit districts had access to help pay, and my school district was one of those that benefited from having transit passes available to students. And I felt strong then, as I feel today, that giving students options of how they get to things besides just school, to employment, other educational opportunities, is important, and especially important in all districts, but those that have access to transit, it's even more important. So the journey that we've been on since then, it has now come to House Bill 4130 and other related efforts. As was the case in 2013, I remain committed today to supporting our students, the school systems, in any manner we can to ensure students have access to the appropriate learning experience, regardless of whether it is located at the school or someplace else in the community. House Bill 4130 is a small but important step in creating more options for students and school districts to engage students in ways that not only keeps them in school, but leads to them graduating. The bill recommends, as Caddy has said, recommends some minor changes to existing rules and policies to allow districts more flexibility on how they use existing district transportation assets. Starts with a modest $250,000 investments that will fund some small grants to those districts who qualify and can demonstrate a plan on how additional investments can support the student and learning experience. And again, it's important to understand here that many of our rural districts don't have access to transit, so we want to make sure what this does is provides options to them too, not just to those districts that have access to transit. More importantly, though, when coupled with other efforts and hopefully increased investments in the future, House Bill 4130 helps districts respond to at least one of the barriers that hamper students' abilities to experience the learning environment at its fullest. I ask that you support House Bill 4130 and help us take another small step in this journey of ensuring students have full access to all the educational opportunities available throughout their districts in our communities. Thank you for your consideration.
And Chair McLean, I would like to add one other thing. This work group started working probably 2 years ago. We worked through for about, we met many, many times. And I just wanted you to understand what a broad coalition of people were involved in this discussion from the very, very beginning. We had OEA, OSEA, COSA. We had our transit unions. Who else did we have, John? We had representatives from school districts, large and small. We had the city of Portland, Portland Public Schools. Many, many people were engaged in this conversation, and there was a lot of effort that went into getting to this very specific piece of legislation. This didn't, it was a long road with a lot of input. From people from all over the state representing all the factions involved. So I just wanted to thank all of them for their participation. People spent hours and hours and hours in meeting rooms coming to this bill, and I just wanted to give them a shout out and thank them for their work. We thought we were going to have a student with us today testifying. You'll see in your meeting materials a letter from Violeta Mata. I don't think she arrived. Okay, they're running late, so she is not here to testify with us today, but she submitted written testimony. You may see her a little bit later, but she's the student voice for this bill and brings, of course, an important perspective as well, but I certainly would ask that you seriously consider supporting this very important piece of legislation to our students across the state. And it is limited to grades 9 through 12, by the way. That's one other thing I didn't mention.
Thank you both for being here this morning and for the presentation. I believe we have a question from Vice Chair Vile.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just wanted to express gratitude to my colleagues for working on this and bringing this. And I think it's important maybe to point out that while sometimes we talk about these assistance type of bills for particularly our inner city, this bill has been crafted in a way that's very balanced and helps our students throughout the state, including our rural areas. And I really think it's been done very well. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative.
Other questions or comments for our panel here today? Yes, Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I would just have a question about what the advocates for the payroll tax to fund public transit, what they think about this. And
if we'll find out when we have the hearing on it next week.
Okay.
Yes. We have asked a number of them. And it's transit money, and it's a very small amount, is going directly to transit. So the fact that it does not leave that bailiwick, it stays within the confines of transit, we have not had a lot of pushback yet. But again, it will be heard when we bring that section of the fix-it bill, is what we're calling it, next week in committee. So we've run the trap line and asked the question and haven't had a lot of pushback yet because it's confined, but we'll certainly find out.
Yeah, nice idea. You know, just people jealously guard pots of money sometimes. So
certainly do. Certainly do. And I clearly understand why. This would be, we'll find out next week.
Yep.
So thank you for the question.
Sure.
Thank you very much. And Representative Salinas.
So you mentioned the stiff funding, and it was 1% on top of the $200,000 starter pot. How much will that equate to?
We originally, Representative Lively and I, in our first go around with this, when times were a little bit different, were requesting $5 million to be put into this pot to start it out for activity bus transit in a mix. We're asking for $250,000 this time because we just want to get it started, and we're very, very sensitive to the fact that we have some budgetary constraints, and we want to be reasonable about the request. The STIF, the estimate is it will generate somewhere in the neighborhood of $105 to $125 million a year. 90% of that will be used for this operational money that transit organizations will be applying for. And I did contact all of them. They are comfortable with this from what I am hearing so far. But this is a new idea. We just, this is relatively new. My first request was just, let's take $1 million out of that And then when I walked to talk to Ledge Council, talk to folks that we're working with on the transportation package, talk to my colleagues, we just decided that 1% would be reasonable. It's going to be somewhere around $1 million. We were asking for five. Yeah. So in the big scheme of things, relatively minor.
Other questions or comments for our panel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
We appreciate you being here this morning and for bringing this legislation.
I appreciate your time.
At this time, I'm going to close the public hearing on, unless there's no one else on our list, by the way, so I'm not being arbitrary about this. There's no one else on our list. So I'm now going to close the public hearing for House Bill 4130. And I'm going to open the public hearing for House Bill 4054. And this is the City of Portland ODOT cleanup agreement. And we have a panel, but I want to recognize Senator Monroe and Representative Reardon. And if you have others that you wanted to bring in the first panel, that's fine.
Thank you. We'll kick things off.
Okay.
My senior partner here will
okay.
start.
Thank you very
Senator
much.
Monroe,
Thank
welcome.
Thank you very much, Representative McLean. Susan and I have been friends for a long time. I am Rod Monroe, Senate District 24, and Representative Reardon has House District 48, which means we both represent together the area where this bill will have the greatest impact. Everybody knows that homelessness and homeless shelters and homeless camping is a problem that we need to deal with. One of the worst places is the intersection of I-205 and the Springwater Trail and Johnson Creek. Johnson Creek and the Springwater Trail flow under I-205. So some of that property around that intersection is controlled and owned by ODOT, some of it by the City of Portland. And the problem today is that you often have homeless camps that are set up on land that is controlled by ODOT, and ODOT moves in and tries to clean things up. They use Johnson Creek as their toilet. They restrict activity along the Springwater Trail. Springwater Trail is used by bicyclists and pedestrians. And goes all the way into, basically connects all the way into downtown Portland and out all the way to Gresham and to Boring. So Springwater Trail is a pretty important place, and yet I hear from constituents all the time, especially women, that they're afraid to use the Springwater Trail. They're fearful, whether that's legitimate or not, it is restricting the use of that very important trail. Now, I was personally involved in the plans to build that trail when I was chair of JPAC at Metro, when Susan and I served on Metro together. And so I kind of feel a little protective of the Springwater Trail, you might say. This bill is very simple. It simply allows ODOT and the City of Portland to enter into an intergovernmental agreement so that you don't have one jurisdiction moving people out and they move across the street, and then the other jurisdiction has to come along and what do I do with these folks, and so on. So it simply allows an intergovernmental agreement. Now, we have found that the City of Portland has had a lot of experience with moving homeless camps to a place where they're safe, moving them away from pristine riparian areas like along Johnson Creek. The City of Portland's had more experience with that, Laurelhurst Park and other places, than ODOT. ODOT's very good at planning and building highways, maybe they need a little help sometimes when it comes to what do you do with these homeless camps that are set up. Now, I drive down there all the time past this intersection,
It's my way to get to I-205 and down here to Salem, or get on the MAX and go downtown Portland. All are right there in the same location. And it's troubling and causes fear among my constituents when they have to go through these massive homeless camps and past all this filth just to get on their MAX train or just to get down to the store. There's a grocery store down there on that corner and so on. This bill is very simple. It simply allows, permits, it's not mandatory, it's permissive, permits ODOT and the City of Portland to enter into an intergovernmental agreement so that they are working together to deal with this very serious problem. And because of that, I really appreciate the fact that my colleague, Representative Reardon, has drafted this legislation, and I've signed on as a co-sponsor. And hopefully, even in this very short session, you will move it. It's simple, and it needs to be done. This is the kind of good government that Republicans and Democrats ought to be able to get behind, because it deals with a real problem in a non-sectarian way. Thank you for your attention.
Representative Reardon.
Good morning, Chair McLean, members of the committee. I am Representative Jeff Reardon with House District 48, serving Southeast Portland and Happy Valley. And I think the senator really described the problem very well, but I'd like to go over it a little bit. So I want to thank you for hearing this bill in the first place. But it's emphasized how important it is to not only the people that that live in homes in the area, but I think also to the people that are on the trails and living out there, if we can find a way to provide, through this bill, provide better service to them. So it's important to the entire community. My office has been inundated with calls from neighbors that are impacted by encampments, and they just keep increasing every year. And I ride Springwater Corridor, right around my bicycle, and so I kind of monitor things, and there's ebb and flow to it. But I think one thing that really struck me late last summer, and I worked with a principal at Lent Elementary School, and he was talking about there's an ODOT pathway that's across the field and up behind the school. So kids are coming to school, walking a lot along the ODOT road, going across that field and through the sidewalks, and they're wading through human waste, garbage, and a lot of needles. Yeah. And I'm just thinking, that's just no way for a kid to start their day at school. Okay. So I started to ask around. I do have a good working relationship with the City of Portland and the county as well in terms of how do we address what I think is really a public health issue. And so found a background. I think the senator described it pretty well. But basically, we have ODOT property. We have city property. You can't tell which is which unless you have your map or your handy device with you. And both of those agencies, both government forms of government, are using different methods and different timelines and so forth in how they serve the area. And frankly, the City of Portland is, they've really worked hard to work and serve the homeless, and I think they do have an expertise that they've developed. So they, and actually in the past, the two jurisdictions really have worked hard at coordinating. They have weekly and safety social services coordination calls, but there's just a difference in their governing laws that makes it a real challenge. And you'll have experts back here that'll explain that a little bit more. But so all we want to do is address some of those barriers that are in statute right now and allow the city and ODOT to come to an agreement on how to serve these areas. I mean, it really is that simple. It is, I call it a technical fix. It is permissive for ODOT, and I think it opens the door. Maybe it's a first step for how we can work smarter, more efficiently. Without this legislation, the parties are still stuck. They're going to continue I mean, literally, here's how it is. You might have an ODOT vehicle providing services, and right behind that, a city crew doing the same thing, just feet apart from each other. So we think it's a lot smarter, more cost-effective, and provide better service if one agency can do that work. So clearing the way for better management of public spaces and services across jurisdictions will improve our ability to address the causes and symptoms of homelessness with compassion and improve public trust in government. Well, emphasize, this is not a sweep bill. I've heard it referred to a couple of times as such. It is definitely not. It simply allows the agencies to work together, to work smarter, more cost-effectively. I'm very proud to sponsor this bill, and I hope we can make progress for all involved.
Yep. Thank you, Senator Monroe and Representative Reardon. And I wanted to let you guys go first because I know you had been waiting, Senator. But I do want Patrick, before we go to questions, to do the basic on telling us where the bill is. We have an amendment, and please fill us in on where we are on this one.
Sure, Madam Chair. This bill, as the sponsor has described, authorizes ODOT to enter an IGA with the City of Portland. There is a dash one amendment which revises the language of the measure. It was received from Representative Reardon, so you might ask if he would be or willing to do it, or somebody else who's coming up later might also be willing to give a quick background on it. This measure does not have a subsequent referral, so it would go directly to the floor should the committee decide to report it out.
Okay, I believe the City of Portland was going to talk about that amendment.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, Elizabeth Edwards with the City of Portland, thank you for this opportunity. The dash one amendment is an attempt to clarify the language that's in the underlying bill. They should substantively be the same. The intent behind the amendment is to make a clear statutory reference to the governing statute for local governments. So it's it points directly to 203.079, required elements of local government policies on camping by homeless. So it's what we're already operating under as a local government. We had attempted initially in the draft to pull some of that language. So you see the underlying bill is longer than the Gut and Stuff Amendment. This cleans it up by just pointing to that section of code.
Okay. Are there any questions either about that amendment or for our senator and representative today? We have others who are going to testify on this. Okay. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. And Elizabeth, if you'd like to stay up here. And Lucas Hillier, is that right? Would you like to come up as well? And how about, is it Mark Jolene?
Yeah.
Chair McLean, committee members, with your indulgence, I'd just continue my rambling. So thank you to Representative Reardon for leading the charge in this bill, and to Senator Monroe for his kind words. Coordinating across multiple jurisdictions and nonprofit partners is challenging, even in the best of circumstances. But it becomes especially challenging when also dealing with vulnerable populations. So the city has spent a significant amount of time, resources, thoughts, concern in order to figure out a way to better manage property and coordinate services for people who are living outside. So I've brought Lucas Hillier and Mark Jolin here, who will be able to get into a little bit more of the details about what our operations look like, what the situation is on the ground. But in my role here on this at this table, I'd like to take a moment to sort of highlight why the legislation is necessary. And I think we touched on it a little bit, but just a quick history lesson. We have both the City of Portland and the Oregon Department of Transportation having different settlement agreements with the Oregon Law Center for how we manage properties and people. The ODOT settlement agreement is codified in part in Oregon state statute. And so what we're doing today, and the intent of this bill, is to basically say, should the department decide to enter into an intergovernmental agreement with the city, this is the space that they can operate in. So creating an exception to the language that's currently in code, but still operating under robust sideboards. Really, this is just the first step in creating a better coordinated approach, but it really is a first step. It's not a panacea. It's not solving anything, but it's helping to start continuing the conversation and taking a step forward. Otherwise, we're going to be stuck in the same loop over and over again. So I'm going to stick around for questions, but at this point, I will turn things over to Lucas.
Thank you.
And please give your name for the record.
Yes, Chair McClain and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lucas Hillier, and I'm the program coordinator for the City of Portland's Homelessness and Urban Camping Impact Reduction Program. Excuse me. My job is to lead coordinating efforts for the City of Portland with regional partners and manage campsite cleanups, interactions with multiple city entities, regional partners, and social service providers in the City of Portland. I'll keep my statements brief, but wanted to let you know what we're currently doing to collect this data and what we're doing with it. So I started with the City of Portland as a school social work intern from Portland State University. And one of my projects was to create the One Point of Contact system. Prior to the One Point of Contact system, none of this data about camps around the City of Portland was getting housed anywhere. It was just kind of flying around, and it was really frustrating for the community when interacting with the city because no one had an answer or knew how to do anything with it. Let me get back here. What we found is by making a lot of this information public and capturing it in one place, the transparency helps build trust and heads off unnecessary misunderstandings and conflicts. So we created a homelessness toolkit, which is it basically provides information to the general public. It has links to resources for individuals experiencing homelessness. Resources for people who want to volunteer, so it has volunteer opportunities. And it facilitates, and it has links to the One Point of Contact system. So the One Point of Contact system is primarily a reporting mechanism for the City of Portland. It all gets housed into a database. We're able to share and collect data. With the reports that we receive, we have a partnership with an agency called Central City Concern. They have several pickup trucks with individuals, most of whom were formerly experiencing homelessness themselves. They go to these camps, they pass out garbage bags, interact with folks, and provide measurable data back to us about the conditions of the campsite as it is. We then put that through a scoring system and decide what our next level of intervention is going to be. These metrics include evidence of conspicuous drug use, like needles and whatnot laying on the ground, the amount of trash, so an impact on neighborhood livability and businesses, their proximity to a school or a playground, the environmental impact the camp is having on the space that they're in, restriction of ADA access, is it completely blocking the sidewalk or not, the size of the encampment, verified reports of violence or crime, and we coordinate with police to get that kind of information. Are they blocking public spaces like a stairway up to a park, that kind of thing, and then do they restrict maintenance activities for areas like pump stations and whatnot. Based on the information that we get back from those crews, we determine our next level of intervention, and that can either be just continue sending a crew out to interact with the campers, share resources with them, and pass out garbage bags and manage the trash, or are we going to take it the next step where we post it and clean it and ask people to move. The flow chart on here kind of, and I think we provided this in the record, this gives a sense of how the information comes in and how it gets out.
I think they want you to speak up just a little.
All right. I shy away from microphones. Flexible. So the data that we receive through this system, we send out a weekly report to both social service providers, law enforcement, city entities, the joint office. So we make everybody aware of what we know, what we plan to do, and try to give social service an opportunity to do their outreach and keep track of individuals that they're working with. The system was built to make information accessible to the public and make cooperation and collaboration streamlined and efficient. And thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair McClain, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mark Jolin. I'm the director of the Joint Office of Homeless Services for the City of Portland and Multnomah County. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. The Joint Office was formed about a year and a half ago to oversee the implementation of our local community-wide effort to address homelessness. We are primarily a planning and contracting office that allocates local and state funds to a range of programs, from street outreach to emergency shelter and transitional housing, and to permanent housing placement and retention services. While our office doesn't directly participate in cleanups, we do oversee a weekly safety and social services coordination effort around cleanups, and we contract with various outreach teams that work with the unsheltered population. I've been involved personally for a long time with the challenges of how to balance the needs of people who are having to live their private lives in public spaces with the need to keep those public spaces clean, healthy, and accessible for a range of purposes. Portland's current approach, and the one that the city would use if given the opportunity to enter into an IGA with ODOT, has a number of important benefits. Perhaps most importantly, and Lucas referenced this, this is an extremely transparent system. The weekly email distribution and online posting of the precise addresses of all camps scheduled to be posted and cleaned creates, frankly, an unprecedented clarity for the community, including those who are unsheltered and the social service outreach teams who work with them. This transparency heads off misunderstandings and builds both trust and accountability. The city's approach is also very intentional, as Lucas pointed out, about focusing limited cleanup resources on high-impact encampments and using other creative strategies like garbage pickup and social service engagement to work with other campers to avoid cleanups and enforcement actions. Through our weekly service coordination calls that include all local law enforcement agencies, parks, transportation, and multiple social service outreach providers, there's also a level of coordination between public safety and social services around the people impacted by cleanups that I've not experienced before. These calls and the relationships that have formed through them have helped mitigate the impacts of cleanups on campers, frequently connecting them with vital services. Finally, I do believe that there is significant value to all involved having consistency within city limits regarding camp cleanup, notification periods, enforcement practices, property storage policies, and the like. So I thank you for considering giving Portland the opportunity to pilot this collaboration with ODOT.
Thank you very much. At this time, are there any questions for the panel? Seeing no questions for the panel, thank you very much. I appreciate your time here today. At this point, and I've been calling people up in the order they signed up today because that was my way of dealing with the list, and maybe I should do it a different way, but I'll think about it. And I'm going to go next with Marion. Is it Haynes, please? And would you like to please join Kimberly? Is it McCullen? Yes, thank you. And then Sybil Heeb. And we'll start with Marion. Please give your name for the record.
Yeah, good morning, Chair McClain, committee members. My name is Marion Haynes. I'm the Vice President of External Affairs for the Portland Business Alliance. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm here in support of this bill. homelessness has been a challenge in the city of Portland for quite some time, and it's very difficult to address, very vexing. There's a lot of components to it. You know, we really believe that nobody should be sleeping outdoors. That's not the humane approach. And so then there are also the, as you heard, some of the safety and health impacts of some of these camps. So it really takes a multi-pronged approach, and we've been really pleased with the efforts that the city and Multnomah County together have been making to try to address these issues. They've really stepped up the efforts in important ways, expanding shelter services, working on some of the cleanups for those really high impact areas. And I think what's become really evident over the past couple of years is that trying to address this issue really requires an unprecedented level of collaboration. And we understand in the private sector that we have a role to play in that too. I meet regularly with Mark Jolin and folks on his team to try to support their efforts. We've had multiple private property owners step up and open up their buildings to provide indoor options for people. We actually, under our umbrella, have the Downtown Portland Clean and Safe program, which also has a role in some of these cleanups. And there really is a health and safety impact at times for some of these. We've found in the work that we do just within the downtown area, it's not ODOT property, but we've seen a huge spike in the number of hypodermic needles we've had to pick up, biohazards. There really are some issues that that need to be addressed. And I think the city's approach, as you heard, really tries to take a compassionate approach and how you're addressing this very difficult situation. So I will leave it at that, but I think this does provide an opportunity for the city and ODOT, should they come to an agreement, to really rationalize the service delivery that they do on some of those properties. It is a big issue in the city of Portland. We recently conducted a poll, and homelessness and dealing with the impacts of that is far and away the most important issue that voters identify in the city. So this really will provide an opportunity to help address that key concern. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair McLean, Vice Chair Vile, and Vice Chair Meek, and members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today to speak about this bill. I want to clarify for the committee that the Law Center, with the -1 amendments, is neutral on this bill. We do appreciate the work that the city has done with ODOT to try to come up with some ways to collaborate and coordinate with respect to their interactions with camps and people sleeping on the streets within the city of Portland. I want to just take a minute to sort of step back from the perspective of our low-income clients. Housing and the housing crisis and the ability to find and achieve stable and safe affordable housing is the biggest crisis impacting our communities across the state. And I think we've all heard that, and the legislature has heard that over the last year or so. We really appreciate the efforts that the legislature is making to try to resolve this problem at the beginning and to reduce the incidence of homelessness. We have 13,000 Oregonians, more than that, in the 2017 most recent point in time count. And there were 22,000 children who were homeless at some point in time during the last academic school year. So this is a huge crisis. We appreciate the efforts like the document recording fee, tenant protections, other measures to try to resolve this crisis and create greater stability at the outset. That said, we understand that there are competing needs that the city and ODOT are trying to manage with respect to neighborhoods and also our neighbors who are houseless. We think that camps are one way that neighbors who are houseless can protect themselves and create some community and provide some greater stability for themselves. And so we are very concerned about any disruption of that community and that safety. As the city and ODOT are thinking together about how to coordinate, then we really hope that all of their principles will be designed around, as Mr. Jolin and Mr. Hillier spoke about, the harm reduction and efforts to mitigate prior to any removal of camps and community. Those removals can be devastating. They can be deadly. They disrupt homeless neighbors' efforts to reinstate stability in their lives and to access services. So we hope that any policy that is implemented will have sweeps or removal as a very, very last resort, and only when there are other resources and possibilities that are safe and available for people who are to be removed. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair McLean, members of the committee, my name is Kimberly McCullough. I am here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. And like the Oregon Law Center, we are neutral on the bill today, but I felt the need, and our organization felt the need, to come here to share a bit of context and some of our hopes with this committee. We all know that we're in a housing crisis, and really that housing crisis just continues to get worse and worse. It is because of that housing crisis, it is because of the lack of affordable housing and the lack of shelter that people are homeless. I think that, unfortunately, there is still a lot of deep discrimination in our society, where homeless people are blamed themselves for the circumstances that they're in. I heard a comment earlier about protectiveness, and I guess I have to say I'm a little protective of myself, of our friends and community that are facing the situation. I just like to reiterate, the reason that people are homeless is because there is a lack of affordable housing, full stop. So what are homeless folks facing right now, right, when they're out on the street? They have nowhere to go. They're moved from place to place to place. Each time they're moved, they lose more and more of their belongings. They're constantly being broken up from the community that they find. And being broken up in that way creates an intense lack of safety because of the isolation. So when they try to find a place to be with other folks, to create that safety, when we move them along over and over again, we are making people incredibly less safe. When there's not enough housing and there's not enough shelters, and then even when there's shelters, often shelters are not safe places for everyone. In particular, I've spoken to a lot of women who have had dangerous situations happen in shelters. So literally people are often just trying to be as invisible as possible so that they can survive, and that creates a really difficult situation because when you're really invisible, you're incredibly vulnerable. And if you're not invisible, there are a lot of people who will unfortunately lash out at folks in this community. And I know that there's a lot of fear from housed people about the houseless community, but what I'm here to say is that people who are houseless and on the street are often the most vulnerable. So to the topic of what do we do, and of sweeps, frankly. And I know there was a comment earlier about this bill not being about sweeps, but I would like to respectfully disagree. Because what we are talking about is a situation where ultimately people are swept from spaces that they convene with each other. And I'm absolutely not here to impugn the character of our colleagues at the City of Portland, particularly the folks who spoke earlier today. I have no doubt that they and many, many people care very deeply and are trying to come up with creative solutions. But what I have to say is I'm a bit disappointed that we tend to be focusing on how we can do sweeps in a more humane manner rather than thinking about how we can get beyond sweeps. And that's what I hear consistently from the folks that I work with in the houseless community is we don't want better sweeps. We want to do better than sweeps. Until we have enough housing, there are going to be camps. And there are actually amazing communities of people who are houseless themselves and who work with houseless folks who want to come up with creative solutions. And one of those creative solutions is trying to find spaces where they can build safe camps. Because again, we don't have enough shelter space, we don't have enough housing. And people need to be able to find a space to be together, to be safe. Right to Dream is a really great example of how that happened in the City of Portland. Dignity Village is another really great example. And I wish I didn't have to remind folks that Right to Dream faced a lot of opposition from the government for a very long time from the City of Portland. And fortunately, they've gotten past that and now are working together. And it's that working together that we want to see more of. What we also want to see more of is the voices of people who are actually houseless being heard in this body. And I wish I also didn't have to remind folks here that last year the houseless community themselves brought the Right to Rest Act to this body and didn't even get a hearing. Despite the fact that they knew that there was no chance of their bill getting passed, they just wanted a voice. So my hope is that when I come back next year with folks from the houseless community, that the City of Portland, that ODOT, that this body will be willing to work with folks from the houseless community on the creative solutions they have of ways that we can actually improve their lives. I have submitted some testimony. It's some documents to the committee. I don't know if it's up online yet. One is a report that we at the ACLU of Oregon published last year. We had some amazing interns who did work that identified 224 municipal laws that specifically target people for doing activities that they are doing simply to survive when they live on the street. I would encourage you to read that report and get some context about what's actually going on with folks. I also submitted some testimony on behalf of Sisters of the Road, which is an amazing community and cafe in the City of Portland that serves this community and works with this community and seeks to empower them, because that's what we need. We need empowerment so that people can actually be lifted up with dignity And then I also submitted an article from Street Roots, from the editor of Street Roots, that talks about how this is really an opportunity for us to think of creative solutions and really move beyond the conversation about sweeps. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and we're trying to make sure that they're up. We're not quite sure they're up yet, but we will work on that right away. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, questions? I think Representative Witt was first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to point out that the two colleagues of ours that appeared earlier, I don't think in any way made reference to sweeps. I find them both to be very compassionate individuals. I found their testimony to be very compassionate, very understanding. I in no way saw blame laid on homeless people for their plight. What I heard was an effort to address a problem of trash that potentially could impact human health, societal health, and environmental health. And I just want to say that I thought their presentation was entirely compassionate. So thank you.
Thank you for your comment. Did you have a response?
Yeah, I would. As I said a moment ago, the folks who spoke before us, we have no problem with them.
Thank you. And
do know that they're trying to do things in a compassionate manner. We do, unfortunately, as a society, still have a lot of discrimination, and we still have issues that we need to face, and that was what I was trying to address.
Thank you for your comment. Representative Vile.
I just want to reinforce what Representative Witt just said. And our friends at ACLU and Oregon Law Center are doing great and really, really important work. But I've been all over the world and seen poverty that is just despairing and grinding to the point that I can hardly believe it. And yet, whether it's Antananarivo, Madagascar, or the slums of Cape Town, folks take care of themselves. They camp in ways, they set themselves up in ways that actually protect their own health, their own lifestyle, in ways that are much better than what I've seen when I am out in the areas that were described earlier today. And I think we have to begin to really recognize that everyone has to take responsibility for themselves the best they can. I'm troubled when I hear that the word discrimination used in connection with some of these conversations, because it implies that if I don't let folks just do whatever they want to do, I have no heart. And that is simply not the case. We absolutely do have to make sure that we are recognizing the need to police ourselves, whether it's in a housed community or a homeless community. And I think that the effort simply to give tools to these folks to coordinate the ability to clean things up has nothing to do with discriminating against the homeless. So I hope that we can make clear, I maybe said it a little bit stronger than Representative Witt did, but Senator Monroe, I know for a fact, has that kind of heart. My good colleague in the House of Representatives who's sitting right behind you right now, there's nobody that had a better heart than him. So let's be very careful about this. Thank you.
Okay. Are there questions for the panel? Okay. Representative Noble?
I wish I had a better question. This is a comment. And in my experience, I've had the unfortunate experience of working and having to do sweeps, working in these areas where people who are homeless have been victims of crime simply because they're homeless, and still having to have compassion and still figure out a way for this to happen. I absolutely applaud this idea of governments working together and having you at the table. I sit on housing. I know the issues. it's larger than just what this committee can deal with. Mm-hmm. But having you at the table helps, essentially, and without impugning any of my colleagues at all, this is a cleanup mm-hmm. in a compassionate way, in ensuring that people are taken care of in the right way, treated appropriately. Having been on the front lines and having to do that, having to administer that being done, it's not an easy task, and it does involve all of us at the table. I absolutely am in favor of this bill because I think it's a step in the right direction. Hopefully we'll get a long-term solution so we won't have to deal with it, but thank you for being part of it.
Thank you very much. Is there a question? Okay.
Yes, a suggestion, question. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm putting my land use hat on. I was just like Representative Viola, planning commissioner with the county, Clackamas County. And we just went through a process of rezoning some land mm-hmm. in Clackamas County to allow for a veterans shelter, a veterans mm-hmm. homeless shelter that we kind of planned and organized. And I want to find out, have your organizations communicated with the city of Portland, Multnomah County? We're very fond and very proud of our land use system in Oregon, and people really defend it vigorously. And so part of managing the issues we have to deal with, I think that fundamentally we have to go back to the table with either the city of Portland, both Clackamas County and Multnomah County, Washington County, and instead of just allowing a camp to develop on its own, is to plan some opportunities.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. that way we can provide for, you know, sanitary systems, et cetera, removal of garbage. My suggestion is that maybe, and I'd be willing to support and help that, to get to these municipalities and try to collaborate on that level. And then we can make it safer, more sanitary, and more environmentally friendly. So thank you.
Chair McLean and Representative Meek, one comment, which is that's exactly what we're asking for.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. I don't think we have any questions for this panel, so I'll thank you very much. And thank you, committee, for being thoughtful in your responses. Okay, at this time, this bill is to be a partnership, and so I've asked the director of ODOT, Director Garrett, if you would come forward, please. I think it's important to have both sides of this partnership to talk about what this bill is and is not, and also maybe some of the potentials to make it the best it could possibly be, that there might be some other ideas and thoughts.
Appreciate it. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Matthew Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. I appreciate the words, the very eloquent words that all the folks before me shared with this committee. I will tell you, my sentiment, Ms. Edwards broached it. I think the language we have in front of us in House Bill 4054 and the Dash 1 amendments that I think bring some clarity. This approach is an important first step in our attempt to better align the notification timelines, the property removal and inventory protocols that are not in sync, and that creates awkwardness here. I can assure this committee, I can assure the good folks in the audience, that my agency will continue to partner with the City of Portland, with the Oregon Law Center. I would submit we need to bring all voices to the table, a collective wisdom to answer that, so I would include other stakeholders to identify and remove any barriers that exist to prevent the coordination and the collaboration that is embedded, I think, in this piece of legislation right now. So we stand ready to partner with this. We can do better. We are out of alignment. There is an opportunity to bring a conversation, hopefully all voices to the table, to ensure that there is better alignment.
So I guess I have a question. The first question that I have is, do you think we have the language in the Dash Ones to actually have that type of conversation and include the kinds of folks that were here today that, you know, necessarily need to be involved in the overall conversation?
I think we can be a little more intentional. I think there is an opportunity to bring maybe the League of Oregon Cities or the Association of Counties, private sector, for Ms. Haynes spoke to the investment and the resources being put forth by the private sector. So again, I think there are other voices from all sides, including those folks in the homeless service professionals, social service professionals. We want to make sure that those folks sit at the table with the City of Portland, with ODOT, and with the Oregon Law Center. I think it was mentioned. We have very prescriptive language in statute and in settlement agreements, and we're going to have to work through those opportunities. This language in 4054 helps navigate those waters here. But bringing all voices to the table, I believe, will help bring solutions to the table.
All right, any other questions? Yes, Representative Noble.
Thank you, Chair. I do have a question, and I think I understand why we're at the Portland ODOT connection right now. My experience that I talked about was in Corvallis, dealing with the state highway that goes over the Willamette River, and I see opportunity probably to partner in the future. I also, in my current district, have a brand new highway with a lot of bridge over some very pristine, both river riparian areas, and wondering if, as Representative Meek mentioned, being proactive to come up with solutions before it's a problem where we're having to move people. It's just, I know this is probably beyond the scope of this, but I would encourage in the, maybe some proactive work in being able to enter into an IGA with other governments throughout the state specifically for this.
Understood.
Well, I have another question because of that then. What you're just talking about is something that I had a question about, which is, you know, we have how many cities, you know, how many jurisdictions in the state of Oregon? And I think we heard that we were trying to unify and we were trying to make sure we didn't have a patchwork quilt, you know, type of approach with this area. And so what do you think about what Representative Noble said as far as how do we get to that larger conversation?
I think, Madam Chair, it's certainly a legitimate issue. We know, unfortunately, this situation we find in Portland plays itself out across the state, in the various cities and the various counties across the state. I think, again, bringing that collective wisdom to the table to inform, inviting those folks to the table to deal and tailor solutions specific to those unique areas, because each bring something different. Now, that's beyond the scope, as the good representative indicated. That's beyond the scope of this bill. But it is a pathway that I think if we don't get to now, we'll have to get to soon, because this is a challenge that we face because we have many unanswered challenges on many different levels that, again, compromise the obligations and the responsibilities that I have in as an agency, and the city, their obligations, as well as the social service providers. We need to sync up and align better. I think anything that brings maybe a surgical strike, as well as the opportunity to have a greater conversation because it is a greater issue, mm-hmm. That's legitimate, and my agency will be at the table.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Thank you very much, Director. At this point, I do not have anybody else on my list who has signed up for this issue, and so I would like to we'll wait till the end to go ahead and move. So we're going to just close the public hearing on House Bill 4054, and we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 4064.
Yes, absolutely, Madam Chair. House Bill 4064 allows counties with populations greater than 350,000 to utilize revenues from county-imposed vehicle registration fee for bridges without distributing a portion of the fee to cities within the county. The measure would take effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die. We do also have in our possession a Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment clarifies that monies can be used for payment of debt servicing costs related to bonds or other obligations issued for such purposes. We have submitted fiscal and revenue impact requests for this measure with the Dash 1, have not received them at this point, so we are still waiting the paperwork, Madam Chair. That's where we're at on that. Oh, this measure does, by the way, have a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means, Madam Chair.
Thank you. At this time, welcome. Good to see you here, and glad you got through traffic. We tried to reorganize, get you here.
Thank you, Chair McClain.
Yes.
I appreciate that.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Jessica Vega Peterson. I am the Multnomah County Commissioner for District 3. It is a pleasure to be back here and see a lot of my old friends. First of all, I want to thank you for hearing this bill today, and Chair McLean for submitting this as a committee bill. This bill, House Bill 4064, is really a part of the efforts that Multnomah County has undertaken to create a seismically resilient crossing using our existing vehicle registration fees. This is a really important bill because it's it enables us to move forward with the process that we have of replacing the almost 100-year Burnside Bridge bridge because it's a part of our emergency response system. So for 20 years, Burnside, the entire road, has been considered a lifeline corridor for the region because it does connect east and west Multnomah County. But we know that the bridge is not, in its current state, able to survive a seismic event. In fact, it's a possibility that none of the downtown bridges would be expected to be immediately usable after a major earthquake. So that's why we're taking a look at this as a region of either replacing or retrofitting the Burnside Bridge to really ensure that we have something. During an earthquake, because of how the Burnside Bridge is located, if it were to fall, it would actually impact I-5, I-84, the UP rail line, and as well as the MAX lines, too. So this is a very critical part of the city right there. What we're currently doing now in Multnomah County, we have a $19 vehicle registration fee that was used to pay for the Selwood Bridge, the new Selwood Bridge, which was completed 2 years ago. We received the authority from the legislature to spend 100% of that revenue for that purpose, and the fact is we actually received a very favorable interest rates on the bonds that we use for that bridge, so that we're actually taking in more revenue than what's necessary to pay off those Selwood Bridge bonds. So what we want to do with the additional revenue is to use to get the authority from you to use that money to help speed up the work that we're doing currently on the Burnside Bridge, specifically targeting in the next stage, which is the NEPA stage.
Yeah. We'll get you some water.
Of course, it's like right.
Yeah, of course.
Talking. And I know that everything moves at a breakneck pace during the short session. There's actually a great video about this at burnsidebridge.org. So if you guys have a couple minutes that you want to take a look at it, I encourage you to do that. But really, I'm here today asking you for support of House. Thank you so much. House Bill 4064. Courtney Lords is here from the Multnomah County Attorney's Office. She's going to go through the detail of exactly why we need this authority from you, because I know that there's been some questions from that. After she talks, I'm happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Courtney Lords with Multnomah County Attorney's Office. Again, thank you for holding a hearing on this important bill. I want to reiterate, just so that we all understand, because it's a very convoluted history in terms of the Multnomah County BRF, and I'm not going to bore you with the details, because when I put my clients through the entire history, they literally were like, so if you have specific questions, I'm happy to answer them, but I'm going to give you the abbreviated version. So this bill does not create a new VRF. So you're not giving us any additional authority. We're not implementing a new tax, a new fee, anything like that. It merely allows the county to be consistent with the authorizing legislation that the legislature passed in 2009. And that's to use those funds without triggering a 40-60 city-county split. So the unique piece of this is the 40-60 split that was in the authorizing legislation back in 2009 did not take effect until 2013. So that's an important piece of this, because people say, well, why do you even need this? Well, because in 2013, this came online. So another important piece of this is Multnomah County is unique when you compare it to other counties for lots of reasons, but one of them being that ORS 382-385, way back when, charged the county with operating and maintaining bridges over the Willamette River within the city of Portland. So it was very specific. However, no other county has been given such responsibility for major infrastructure. Additionally, when the legislature charged Multnomah County with this, it did not immunize the county from other statutory city-county cost-sharing, and it did not establish a direct or a direct funding source for these operation and maintenance costs. So as Commissioner Vega Peterson stated, HB 60 or 4064 will allow the county to use its existing VRF for purposes other than the Selwood Bridge without triggering that 40-60 split. That said, the initial authorizing legislation was specific to a bridge over the Willamette River within the city of Portland. So we are very consistent with this. We just need this to go through so that if we divert those funds from Selwood, it is clear that this is not triggering a new VRF.
So are there questions? Representative Bile.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner, and appreciate you being here, Courtney. I just want to make sure that we've got on the record this original vehicle registration fee was not something that was subject to voter approval. It was actually county commissioner action. And that was ratified then by the legislature, and the enabling to use those funds for the Selwood Bridge 100% is the action that we now need to modify slightly in order to move those funds from Selwood to the, which bridge is it? Burnside, yeah. Am I correct about that?
So the way that the statute was written back in 2009, it was general to all of the bridges. The difference was that the county at its own level decided to be consistent with what the intent was when the bill was going through the legislature in terms of the county population was we made it specific. So we codified it in the county code to Selwood Bridge. What we are asking to do now is because we have these funds is to broaden this to what the authorizing legislation was from the legislature back in 2009 is to use those funds generally for all of the bridges. So again, it's not a new fee. It's not adding an additional fee. It's just allowing us to codify generally like our authorizing legislation. And again, making it very clear by saying the 40-60 split won't apply. The other comment that you got to that I think is an important distinction is that this did not go to the voters. And the reason being is in the original authorizing legislation, again in HB 2001, back in 2009, was a requirement that any county with a population greater than 350,000 did not need to take it to the voters. And that is still on the books in terms of our laws. So any county with a population less than 350,000 must take it to the voters to get a vehicle registration fee approved.
Thank you. That, Madam Chair, that was the distinction I was anxious that we put on the record. Thank you.
Any other questions, please? Representative Wilson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to make sure the record does reflect, the acronym VRF does stand for Vehicle Registration Fee.
Yes, correct. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Thank you both very much for being here today. We appreciate your time and your energy and bringing this legislation.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you.
Okay. So here we go. So I was trying to keep us on track here so that we got the public hearings done today that we had set out and had advertised that we would do today. But now we have a work session, so I'm going to close the public hearing on our 4064, House Bill 4064. And I'm going to open a work session, but before I do that, I would like to ask Patrick, before each one of these bills, to tell us where we are, what we're doing, and then there will be a motion, and then we will vote today. And if there are any problems, we could take a couple of minutes break to talk to your vice chairs. If there's no problems, everybody knows what's going on. Are we all okay, everybody?
Yeah.
Okay. So at this point, then, I'm going to ask that I'm going to open a work session, and the work session is going to be on House Bill 4062. We're opening that, and I'm going to ask Patrick to give us the background.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 4062, we heard this on Monday earlier this week. It's a bill to modify certain fees for documents and services provided by the Department of Transportation related to the Driver Motor Vehicle Services Division. It also reorganizes some statutes related to the motor vehicle titling and registration, driving privileges, and vehicle business certificates. At that time, we also had before us the -1 amendment, which makes a technical correction to the last section of the bill. With the -1 amendment, Madam Chair, this measure has a minimal fiscal impact. There is a revenue impact that's been issued. It's in your packet. It's on OLIS. With certain adjustments in fees, there is an upward revenue impact to that. And that has been provided. We have been informed by the Legislative Fiscal Office that with the Dash One Amendment, the measure does not require Ways and Means review, and so they have suggested we request that the Speaker rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We have received permission from the Speaker to do so should the committee decide to move the bill out of committee. We can move it directly to the floor rather than going to Ways and Means, Madam Chair, and that's where we're at on it, Madam Chair.
Representative Witt, did you have a question about that?
I do, Madam Chair. Thank you. I'm just curious about the initial thinking of why it would be prudent to have initially wanted to send this to Ways and Means, and why that's no longer a concern.
This is my understanding. My understanding is it's not costing us money. We're going to be to the net good on anything this bill does, is because we already have those services in place. We already do those services. We're not adding any new services. We're not changing any services. And all we're doing is we're trying to be consistent about the fees that we have for similar services. And so both the Speaker's office, it's a routine that we, if it has anything to do with fees or money, that we send it to the other committee with a dual referral. But after looking at the fact that it's not going to cost us more, we're not adding services, we're not changing services, it was the wisdom that we could take this directly to the floor. And we sent a letter asking that question. We got back from all the folks that look at these types of things that indeed was true. Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand that we aren't adding services or necessarily changing services, but that we would be adjusting fees. And I'm still left to wonder whether it would be a good policy to have the Ways and Means take a look at that.
One of the comments that has been given to me, and I am a new chair, so I am learning the process, but in a short session, when we have a lot of budgetary items and a lot of money items that we're sending to the other committee, it was the wisdom of the folks that we would not send this, because in looking at it, this is not one that's going to need much of their time, and it was simply slowing down the process a day or two with work that we believe does not need to be done. It's a good idea, I think, to always have the option to send to the other committee and have a dual referral. But if you have other ideas or you have other requests, I ask that you present those now so we can deal with them before we start the work session.
Madam Chair, I have, thank you for that consideration, and I feel that I may be a lone voice here, but it does concern me that we may be imposing fee increases that I personally feel we should allow Ways and Means to take a look at. I also recognize that my feelings about that may be somewhat unique here, and I don't want to stall the committee's work if I'm a lone voice. So,
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Vile.
Yeah, Representative Witt, I really appreciate your bringing this to our attention, and the idea that anytime we have a revenue adjustment, that actually does go to the overall budgetary consideration, and it makes a lot of sense for us to look at it. In this particular case, where these items are very specific, targeted to very specific services, I don't think it's going to have the kind of general impact on ODOT's budget that would probably cause us to look at maybe adjusting some other things in the budget overall. So my sense is this one is maybe an exception to what you very clearly need to help us understand, which is anytime we have revenue or expenses change, looking at it from a budgetary standpoint is important. But in this case, I'm inclined to think that we're probably correct in going forward.
I appreciate your advice. Thank you.
Representative Noble.
So my question would be then, without going to Ways and Means, there's no authorization to expend any of these monies. that the fees come in, but without a ways and means appropriation, there's no expenditure. Would that be correct?
Well, in my mind, what you just said doesn't follow through with the process that I know. If you want us to get a legal decision.
I don't think it's really necessary for now. It's just Ways and Means is the one who appropriates the money to be spent. This brings money in. There's no way for it to be spent without an appropriation.
My understanding is that if we need a legal decision, we can stop and get one. My understanding is that we passed a budget, and these fees were part of that budget, and these we are adding to the fee, but they are part of the overall budget. We gave those fees a meaning in that budget, and they're not changing unless Ways and Means does that. So where that fee goes today is where that fee will go tomorrow.
I'm not sure that Representative Noble's not correct. However, my sense is that the chair's probably right in that we've already identified the fee itself, and the amount may not be something that is necessarily controlled by that Ways and Means authorization.
Either way, it'd be beyond the policy committee to worry about that.
From a policy standpoint,
I'm all right with this.
Okay, I have an answer. We just found out.
So, Madam Chair, I should clarify that the suggestion that the referral be rescinded on this bill was made by the Legislative Fiscal Office. It was their estimation that this bill did not need the review by the Ways and Means Committee. So how the money, what's happening with this bill is that the fees that are set in statute that used to cover the cost of providing the service or issuing the document. No longer do because the cost of doing those services has increased. As a result, those fees were set originally to recoup the cost, but because they don't now, the money that would otherwise go from those fees to the state highway fund is not going to the state highway fund. That money's being used to cover the department's cost. By increasing these fees, it will send the money to the state highway fund that's supposed to be going to the state highway fund. That's it. So that's where the money would flow.
Yeah.
In my non-legal terms.
I appreciated Representative Witt's question because being on the subcommittee of Ways and Means that would hear this is a common thing for us to hear.
Right. Mm. Absolutely.
And those who know more about this than we do are going to look at this tape and chuckle, I'm sure.
I think we had a lovely discussion. Thank you, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not to in any way impugn the Legislative Fiscal Office, but I would be entirely reluctant to make them the final arbiter of whether something would be appropriately reviewed at Ways and Means or not, because in the reverse circumstances, I don't have enough digits to count the number of times that they have recommended something go to Ways and Means when it should not have. So I think that door swings both ways, perhaps, in this instance. So.
I think it was a very appropriate question, and I think we've had a good morning, you know, thinking a few moments, and thank you for all your questions. But at this time, I would hope that we might have a chance for a motion.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the House Bill 4062-1 amendment dated 2/1/18.
Thank you. Representative Vile moves to adopt House Bill 4062-1 amendment dated 2/1/18. Is there any discussion? Yes.
Just my one question, Madam Chair. Looking through this, I see CDL, 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 air brake, combination knowledge, school bus endorsement, passenger endorsement. And currently, my understanding would be that person would pay $56 and be endorsed for, in theory, all four of those things. And our fee structure now would take that to $220. Per individual, that's a significant increase. I'm late in the game, I understand.
Right. We did get that presentation last session, and they are required to come in and demonstrate to us if the fees are actually meeting the service cost. Mm-hmm. And they did that. And also, we found some fees that were inconsistent and were not consistent for the same services.
Forgive me, who are they? DMV?
DMV. Yeah.
Okay.
And so they did bring that in. We do have members of the ODOT staff. Could you come up, please, for a minute, and we'll make sure that you can add to this question that's been asked by Representative Bonham.
Chair McLean and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. I think if I understand the question from Representative Bonham, and if perhaps you're looking at the attachment to the testimony with the chart that mm-hmm. shows the fees. So on the CDL portion of that, that has to do with the actual skills test that an individual takes to be able to get their CDL or to add an endorsement or get rid of a restriction, that sort of thing. And so that is, you're not going to take that test for times on the same day. You're going to take one test, and several of these cost $0 today. One of them costs $56, I believe, and then the standard CDL test is $70. So the goal in the bill is to make all such tests, which are nearly the same skills test, cost $70 to take that one-on-one, 2.5-hour transaction. So it's not a cumulative 256, I believe you said, but it's the cost of the skills test is $70. Under the bill, they all become 70.
Yes, Representative Bonham.
Oh, thank you. So my understanding, the four separate tests, someone would come in and do each one individually. Currently, they do these now, and they're charged $0, and we want to actually charge them for that 2.5-hour test.
Chair McLean and Representative Bonham, yes, we want to charge them, but keep in mind that many folks don't get all of these endorsements. And if you, your first time you take your CDL, if you take right. it on a truck that has an air brake, you don't have to remove that restriction.
Perfect. That's
so
my
not
question.
Everybody's yeah. taking all the tests.
Okay.
Any other discussion? And thank you very much for your questions. At this time, if there is no further discussion, is there any objection? If there's no objection, then the amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4062 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Thank you. Representative Vial moves House Bill 4062 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion?
Madam Chair,
I
just note that I remain troubled, but I will support the bill.
Thank you very much.
About the Ways and Means referral, just
yes.
the Ways and Means.
Yes. Is there any further discussion? Seeing no further discussion, will the clerk please read the roll?
Representative Bonham?
Yes.
I'm sorry. Representative Evans?
He is excused.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Salinas?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Meek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Vial?
Aye.
Chair McLean?
Aye. The motion passes and the bill will be sent as amended to the floor. Is there, is there somebody who should carry it?
Anybody you'd like to assign that?
Well, how about Vice Chair Meek on this first one?
Sure, thank you, Madam Chair. Happy to.
Okay, at this time, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 4062, and I'm going to open the work session on the House Bill 4111, and this is the fees for real ID, and I'll ask, please, for Patrick to give us an update on where we are.
Sure, Madam Chair. House Bill 4111, we also heard of this on Monday. It clarifies the fees required to obtain a real ID compliant driver license for applicants seeking an original driver license, a replacement driver license, or renewal of an existing license to a real ID compliant license. This measure has no amendment. It also came to us with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. However, we have received a statement of no fiscal impact from LFO on this and a statement of minimal revenue impact. As a result, the Legislative Fiscal Office has recommended, as was the last bill, that this bill not go to the Ways and Means Committee and instead goes directly to the floor. The Speaker's office has approved that letter of request, and so this measure could be moved directly to the floor with no amendments, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. At this time, I'd like a motion.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4111 to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded.
Thank you. Representative Meek moves House Bill 4111 to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be rescinded. Is there any discussion? Seeing no discussion, is
we can have the clerk.
Can we have the roll read, please?
Sorry.
Thank you.
Representative Bonham?
Yes.
Representative Evans?
He's excused.
Representative Noble?
Aye.
Representative Salinas?
Aye.
Representative Wilson?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Meek?
Aye.
Vice Chair Vile?
Aye.
Chair McClain?
Aye. At this time, the motion passes, and this bill will be sent to the floor. Would you like to carry?
Representative Witt and Wilson's bill.
Oh,
so,
yeah. So who wants to carry it?
Representative Wilson wants to carry it. I guess Representative Wilson.
Okay, Representative Wilson will carry this. Thank you.
Thank you, brother.
Okay. There we go. Okay. We are going to have a meeting coming up on this Friday, and it will be at 3 o'clock. And we will be dealing, I guess, with just one bill because we finished all of our work today from this agenda. And so I hope to see you at 3 o'clock. It should be a good discussion. And we're having folks who really want to come and talk about a very full complement of ideas and thoughts on this particular bill. So.
You don't want to work these other two?
I really don't.
We don't have the paperwork.
We don't have the paperwork, and we're trying to be consistent with what we're doing, and so we'll try to do the actual hearing on one day, and then we'll vote on another day. So if there are problems, you're talking to your vice chairs or myself about that. I heard absolutely nothing this time, but if there are, this is to give you an opportunity to think and reflect on what you heard in the hearings today. Yes.
Madam Chair, just quick question on for Friday. I understand it might be very well attended. Do we plan to go beyond 5 o'clock, or how long is the period of time we plan to be in committee?
Well, I mean, I don't think we're going to have hundreds. We're going to have a full room, but I think that what I've heard from both sides of the conversation, that they are asking particular people to come up and make representative comments, and that the others will be there to support in the actual, you know, audience. So we've asked them to be concise and consistent and to make sure that everybody who wants to speak gets a chance to speak. But if there are five people saying the same thing, that they have a representative. So we've tried to make it a doable two-hour meeting.
This is the 4092 discussion.
We're talking about the Aurora Airport.
Yes, 4092. Yep.
I like names and not numbers.
Sorry.
Subjects. They're subjects, not numbers. Okay. So
thank
are we
you,
all?
Chair. Thank you.
Yes. Are we all okay on that? Thank you very much for accepting the additional meeting on Friday, and we'll see you at 3 o'clock. At this time, we'll adjourn the meeting for the day.
Saving us some money, sir.